Thank you all for coming out. It's a great series you have here. It's an honor to be back again. I recommend that Brookhiser book. I'm sure it'll be a great talk. He does go back to Lincoln was profoundly influenced by Washington. It's a good book. So I'm just pleased to be in with all these other speakers. And you set me up right. This is the conventional wisdom is, as you say, Washington retired and was a farmer for 5 years while the country was collapsing and then reappeared. But that's my book goes back and looks at that period. But I'm going to just talk a little differently tonight. I've titled my talk for this group, Washington's Second Revolution. Much of this stuff comes out of the book. It deals with this period, but it takes it a little different ways. Popular revolutions take many forms, some violent and some peaceful. They are marked by fundamental transfers of governing authority, typically from below. It's conventional to categorize the American Revolution of 1776 to 83 as the first modern popular revolution, and the French Revolution, starting in 1789, as the second. Russia began a particularly cataclysmic revolt in 1917, and China finished one in 1949. In recent years, we seem to see revolutions going on almost continuously, from those in Eastern Europe during the late 1980s to the Arab Spring of the early 1910s, with its still unfinished upheavals in Tunisia, Libya, and Syria. We are reminded by results in Russia, Libya, and elsewhere that popular revolutions don't always end well. Some, as in Russia, lead to tyrannies as bad as those that preceded them. Others descend into prolonged domestic chaos, as happened in France and now appears likely in Libya. Without George Washington, either result might have happened here. The former, if he had not retired following our violent first revolution, the latter, if he had not emerged in 1787 for what some historians depict as our peaceful second revolution. So rather than just take something out of the book, I wanted to sort of compose an essay that deals with this issue, which relates to the book, but tries to pull it together. So let me explain. Now, Washington stepped down after the American Revolution and left the Americans' political future to others. Extolled by later historians as the signal event that set the country's political course, this act was similarly praised at the time. Citing examples from Julius Caesar to Oliver Cromwell, British propagandists during the war had scoffed at Americans for rebelling against one King George III, only to gain another in George Washington. Successful rebel leaders inevitably become tyrants, they charged. Indeed, when expatriate American painter Benjamin West predicted that Washington would retire upon the cessation of hostilities, a skeptical King George III reportedly replied, "If he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world." And when he did retire, American ambassador in Paris, Thomas Jefferson, commented, "The moderation in virtue of a single character probably prevented this revolution from being closed, as most others have been, by a subversion of that liberty it was intended to establish." Well, this story is well known. Indeed, it's pictured in this famous picture wall painting, that's in the United States Capitol Rotunda in Washington. That's how important it is. So let me focus instead tonight on the second half of this balancing act. I talk about both in my book, but let me focus on the second half. Washington's role in forming a more perfect union through a second revolutionary intervention. Well, when he retired after the war, Washington hoped for an energetic republic to unite the coastal states and the vast western territories ceded by Britain under the treaty recognizing American independence, all the way, as you see in the map, to the Mississippi River. Washington said as much in his pre-retirement circular letter to the states, which he issued in response to the Confederation's inability to pay its troops and creditors in 1783. A post-retirement trip to inspect his frontier properties in 1784, which showed him the tenuous hold of America had on the West, and how probable it was that the frontiersmen were going to bolt and break to go with England or to Spain, reinforced Washington's conviction that the Articles of Confederation, then looping 13 sovereign states into a loose alliance that lacked the power to tax or command individuals, must be revised to give the central government direct control over interstate commerce, foreign affairs, national defense, and taxing and spending for the general welfare. To him, these were essential to promote liberty, protect property, and preserve American independence. The subsequent breakdown of public order in some states, reckless emission of paper money by others, and a worsening of economic conditions everywhere deepened his fears and those of like-minded Americans. The country was drifting toward the chaos characteristic of popular revolutions, where effective new regimes fail to emerge after the fall of repressive old ones. That was his belief. To illustrate it, I could draw on Washington's letters written during this period with any number of people. Literally hundreds of such letters exist. But let me just pick out those with the Confederation's brilliant but beleaguered Foreign Secretary, John Jay. Now, early in 1786, Jay urged Washington to emerge from retirement long enough to lead an effort for constitutional reform. Quote, "Experience has pointed out errors in our national government which threaten to blast the fruit we expected from our tree of liberty," Jay warned. "I coincide perfectly with your sentiments," Washington replied, "but my fear is the people are not yet sufficiently misled to retract from error." Washington blamed the situation on ignorance among the people regarding the dangers to freedom and property from the excesses of unlimited democracy, and the wickedness by some who sought to take advantage of those excesses for their own gain. Washington wrote in this letter to Jay, "Ignorance and design are difficult to combat. That it is necessary to revise and amend the Articles of Confederation, I entertain no doubt." He'd underlined "no doubt." "But what may be the consequences of such an attempt is doubtful. Virtue, I fear, has in a great degree taken its departure from our land." Well, the anxiety over constitutional reform reflected in this exchange betrayed far more fundamental concerns than mere fears of losing the West, simple hopes for a national market economy, and plain desires to repay government creditors. Though those issues certainly weighed heavily on both men. Their letters, instead, if you look at them all, spoke in terms of calamity and commotion, loss of public virtue, and a breakdown of the social order under the excesses of majority faction, much like the problems we still see when popular revolutions fail to spawn balanced representative governments. "Liberty itself was at risk," Washington wrote, "much as it had been in 1776. But this time the threat came from within. Nothing short of revolution in government was needed to save the United States." Yes, that's his term, revolution. He uses it several times in these letters. Well, by the end of 1786, with a debtors' insurrection in Massachusetts, this is a picture of Washington at this time, wholesale printing of devalued paper money by Rhode Island, and open rebellion in Vermont, Washington began to doubt if Americans were capable of self-government. "Notwithstanding the boasted virtue of America," he wrote to Bostonian Henry Knox, the Confederation's Secretary of War, "we are far gone in everything bad and ignoble." And so to fellow Virginian, James Madison, Washington wrote in November, 13 sovereignties, referring to the states, 13 sovereignties pulling against each other and all tugging at the federal head will soon bring ruin to the whole. Whereas a liberal and energetic constitution well-guarded and closely watched to prevent encroachments, might restore us that degree of respectability and consequence to which we once had fair claim. In short, he's saying, a second revolution was needed to complete the first. Well, in March of 1783, 3 months after these disturbances in Massachusetts died down, Washington wrote to Lafayette, and here's a made-up picture of the two of them together, about the ongoing impact of those of the so-called Shays Rebellion on the campaign for constitutional reform. Washington wrote, "These disorders are evident marks of a defective government. Indeed, the thinking part of the people of this country are now so well satisfied of this fact that most of the legislatures have appointed delegates to meet in Philadelphia in general convention to revise and correct defects in the federal system." Well, by this point, Virginia had picked Washington to lead its delegation, and he was debating whether he would go. His main worries were that the convention had been called merely to propose amendments to the Articles of Confederation, not to form a fundamentally new government. And the people might not yet be ready to accept a revolutionary overhaul. He now wrote in a letter, "A thorough reform of the present system is indispensable, and with hand to heart, I hope the business will be essayed in full convention." Now, fearing that some states might impose limits on their delegates, Washington reiterated his hope that the convention, and again I'm quoting here, that the convention would probe the defects of the Constitution to the bottom and provide radical cures. Only on those terms would he attend. Well, by this point, Washington had written separate letters to Jay, to Knox, and to Madison, requesting their advice that should he go, what should the restructured government look like? He'd written these letters from Mount Vernon. All sent letters back, and he was struck by the similarities of their responses. And from those three letters, he composed an abstract, including the three, working them together in his own hand, an abstract comparing them. All of these proposals, Jay, Knox, and Madison, all envisioned a national government with separate legislative, judicial, and executive branches. Remember, the Articles of Confederation was a one-house legislature, no executive, no legislative, no judicial, and that one house composed of each state had one vote. The states could send as many delegates as they wanted, but they were recallable at will at the by their state legislatures. They were paid by their state legislatures, and so if they didn't do what they wanted, they wouldn't pay them, and they could be instructed by the state legislature. So literally, it was like the United Nations. They were directly responsible to the states. These proposals would get rid of that national government, three separate branches. All three would divide Congress into an elite upper house and a popular lower house. And all three letters reflected an obsession with reigning in the states. Madison's letter wrote, "The national government should be armed with the positive and complete authority in all cases which require uniformity." This became the key feature of America's second revolution, e pluribus unum, one nation out of many states. In his responses to Knox, Jay, and Madison, Washington embraced their proposals and made them his own. He wrote to Jay, "Those enumerated in your letter are so obvious and sensibly felt that no logic can controvert, but is the public mind matured for such an important change?" Expressing similar sentiments to Knox, Washington stated his fear that, quote, "the political machine will yet be much tumbled and tossed and possibly wrecked altogether before such a system as you have defined will be adopted. Jealous of power, state officials," and again I'm quoting here, "would give their weight of opposition to such a revolution," Washington predicted. Nevertheless, he wrote to Jay that he wished to try the convention route and find out what can be effected. It might represent the last peaceful mode of saving the Union. Washington's words. "And should this convention devise a vigorous new constitution under his leadership, Knox wrote back to Washington. You, Washington, would have doubly earned the glorious Republican epithet, the father of your country. And this is the first statue made of Washington. Make no mistake about it. Washington did not want to go, but he now saw it as his civic duty, necessary to protect his legacy and the legacy of his soldiers in the Revolution. And so he went. Americans everywhere understood this and discussed the significance. A typical article, this is from the Connecticut Journal, reported on news that Washington would go. It is with particular satisfaction we inform the public that our illustrious citizen George Washington has consented to serve in the ensuing federal convention. What happy consequence may not all the true friends of federal government promise themselves? This and other popular accounts showed that, even before it began, Americans expected revolutionary change from the convention. Indeed, Washington was greeted in Philadelphia with an essay in one local newspaper declaring, "The more we abridge the states of their sovereignty, and the more supreme power we concentrate in the assembly of the states, the more safety, liberty, and prosperity we will enjoy." Well, reflecting on his commitment to serve, Washington was one of the few delegates to arrive in Philadelphia on time. He duly went to the State House at the appointed day and hour on May 14 to find only Madison and the Pennsylvanians present. They returned daily at the appointed hour, noon, as other delegates trickled in, but it took 10 days to obtain a quorum. In the meantime, meeting privately, the Virginians present, and apparently the Pennsylvanians too, cobbled together the outlines for a new government. It became known as the Virginia Plan because Virginia Governor Edmund Randolph formally offered it at the convention. Little is known about these meetings, where it was drafted, but letters from those present suggest that Washington attended each one and supported the outcome. As one Virginian depicted the still-forming plan in a private letter, nothing less than a revolution in government was brewing. The most prevalent idea, he wrote, seems to be a total alternation of the present federal system and substituting a great national council with full legislative powers upon all the objects of the Union. This sentence effectively summarized the Virginia Plan. People would replace states as the building blocks of a national republic. On matters of national interest, Congress would either dictate to the states or deal directly with the people. When the convention did obtain a quorum, it properly chose George Washington as its president and turned to the matter of rules. Now, this is the only picture, painting, or sketch of Washington made during the convention. And if you this was sold for $1 a piece during the convention in Philadelphia. And if you read the surrounding sign, you'll see that already his being president of this convention is listed about equally with being commander-in-chief of the armies. Well, those rules, I said, it turned to a matter of rules. Those rules provided that so long as it was represented, each state would have one vote, a majority of states represented could carry a vote, and secrecy would obtain throughout. With windows shuttered and doors closed, members met day after day, 6 days a week, for over 3 months. Delegates came and went. States gained and lost representation. New Hampshire, for example, did not appear until late July, by which time New York had already stormed out. Rhode Island never participated. Only Washington and Madison attended every session. With secrecy enforced, the only record of the proceedings came in Madison's private notes of the debate, an official tally of motions and votes, and a scattering of personal writings. Now, the source material limits what we know about Washington's role because as presiding officer, he did not speak on substantive matters inside the hall. We all know that a speaker of a convention or a meeting, Speaker of the House, for example, in Washington, does not speak in the formal debate. Doesn't mean he doesn't have power. Boehner still runs the show, but he doesn't speak, for example. Now, Washington did talk privately with other members, of course, and he voted with the Virginia delegation. He also supervised the deliberations and called on members to speak. The other members, therefore, likely knew where he stood on significant matters. But beyond his oft-stated desire to create a central government with the power to tax, power to maintain an army, and to regulate interstate and international commerce, the record of his specific contributions to the convention remained frustratingly vague. We can only surmise them from the clues available to us. But those clues are revealing, especially his often decisive vote within the Virginia delegation. In the end, for example, after George Wyeth left because his wife was dying back in Virginia, left with a 5-member delegation, Washington typically became the decisive vote within his own delegation. It would split 3-2. And indeed, it was his vote that carried Virginia for the Constitution. If he hadn't voted for it, Virginia wouldn't have backed it at the Constitutional Convention. But that's getting ahead of myself. Let me go back to the beginning in this, talk a little about the Constitutional Convention and Washington's role in it. One day after the convention committed itself to secrecy, the Virginia delegation dropped its bombshell. Having participated in preparing it, Washington clearly conspired in the timing of his delivery. To begin the main business of the convention, as Madison termed it in his notes, Washington called on Randolph, the Virginia governor, then presented his delegation's plan for a new constitution. As presented by Randolph, the plan contained the outlines for a national, that's the word used in the document itself, a national government composed of a 2-house legislature, some sort of a chief executive, and a judiciary with supreme and inferior courts. Citing the discord among the states, the rebellion in Massachusetts, the havoc of paper money, as Randolph calls it in his speech, and its failure to pay its debts, Randolph argued that the old Confederation did not work and I'm quoting here, raised the prospect of anarchy from the laxity of government everywhere. Further, he added, there were many commercial advantages that the U.S. might acquire, which were not attainable under the Confederation. The hope, he said, lay in a national government with power to legislate on matters of general concern and compel obedience. One skeptical delegate in the hall captured the speech's essence in a scribble that he sent off. Sovereignty is the integral thing. We ought to be one nation. Well, Virginia had staked its grounds and forced others to respond. No delegate could doubt where Washington stood. He remained a voting member of Virginia's delegation, called on Randolph to speak first, and never suffered any interruption, so far as we can tell, from what one critic called the governor's long and tedious speech. Clearly, Washington sided with Virginia and its plan. In doing so, he helped to hijack the convention. Congress had endorsed this gathering as a meeting to draft amendments to the Confederation. Washington's Virginia instead proposed using it to scrap the existing government and forge a nation. That very night, Washington likely worked on a long letter that he mailed the next day to Thomas Jefferson in Paris. That letter wrote from Washington, "The business of this convention is as yet too much in embryo to form any opinion of the result. That something is necessary, all here agree, for the situation of the general government, if it can be called a government, yes, is shaken to its foundation and liable to be overset by every blast. In a word, it is at an end, and unless a remedy is soon applied, anarchy and confusion will inevitably ensue." Washington's words. The introduction of the Virginia Plan. After heatedly debating and narrowly defeating a motion to limit the proceedings to amending the Articles of Confederation, the convention accepted the Virginia Plan as the starting point for deliberations and never looked back. Washington sat silent in the hall but surely spoke in private. He wrote at this time privately, "Persuaded I am that the primary cause of all our disorders lie in the different state governments and in the tenacity of that power which pervades the whole of their systems. So long as states retained independent sovereignty, Washington predicted, the country would falter. Well, the initial battle won. The war then raged over the precise structure and powers of Congress, the nature of the executive, protections for state-sanctioned slavery, and a myriad other issues. Washington again remained quiet in the hall, but wrote privately in a letter, "The men who oppose a strong and energetic central government are, in my opinion, narrow-minded politicians or are under the influence of local views." Of all the delegates in the hall, it was Alexander Hamilton and James Wilson, two pro-business nationalists with close ties to Washington, who most vocally defended the open-ended grant of power to the central government. On June 18, for example, after New Jersey proposed its limiting list of powers and an alternative plan for the federal government, Hamilton exploded. "The general power must swallow up the state powers, otherwise it will be swallowed up by them," he declared, and called for abolishing the states altogether. Wilson was more discreet, distancing himself from Hamilton's extreme remarks. He still argued that the states should only survive as, quote, lesser jurisdictions or subdivisions of the nation. Well, from start to finish, Washington presided at the convention without expressing his views on the proper extent of the central government's power. He didn't need to. Ever since his 1783 circular letter to the states, which was then the country's best-known public document other than the Declaration of Independence, Washington stood as the personification of nationalism in the United States. His daily presence at the dais spoke louder than the speeches of anyone in the hall. It gave weight to the Virginia Plan, which implicitly bore his imprimatur. And when Randolph drafted a broad enumeration of congressional powers that the Virginia delegation backed, it included every single one that Washington had publicly endorsed, but omitted some that Madison had long called for. No issue mattered more to Washington than the new government's supreme power and sovereignty. There were other topics for the members to address, some so divisive as to nearly derail the convention, others that every delegate knew would directly impact Washington should he lead the resulting government. They looked to him on these issues too, and he in turn helped to shape the outcome. But national supremacy mattered most to him. He wrote one day before the delegates approved Randolph's list of enumerated powers. He wrote a letter saying, "Vain it is to look for respect from abroad or tranquility at home till the wisdom and the force of the Union can be more concentrated." Well, evidence abounds for Washington's influence in shaping various provisions of the Constitution and for securing the compromises that kept the convention on track, including the Three-Fifths Compromise and the so-called Grand Compromise. But his role in crafting the executive offers as good an example as any of the part he played in Philadelphia. Since everyone presumed that Washington would be the first president, no one could conceive of the position without thinking of him. Indeed, within a year, South Carolina delegate Pierce Butler flatly stated that his colleagues at the convention, and I'm quoting here, shaped their ideas and the powers to be given to the president by their opinion of Washington's virtue. Well, delegates debated the executive on three separate times during that three-month-long convention. In June, during the first of these occasions, they raised virtually all of the issues about the presidency that would later occupy them, but they had trouble even resolving whether one person or a committee of three should hold the office. With Washington in the room, a unitary executive should have seemed obvious to all, especially since every state had just one governor. Fearful of investing too much power in any single person, however, some delegates, including two from Virginia, favored an executive triumvirate, much like those of late Republican Rome. Denouncing a single executive as, quote, the fetus of monarchy, Randolph averred that the people would oppose it. Further, George Mason, Washington's neighbor, added that an executive troika could better represent the country's three regions than any one ruler. These comments on a single executive, coming as they did from old friends, surely vexed Washington, who prided himself on his Republican virtue, public support, and unbiased nationalism. Every delegate who knew him well must have understood that Washington would never consent to serve as one member of an executive triumvirate, nor would he be particularly well suited for such a post. While he remained silent in the chair, others rallied to defend the sort of unitary executive that Washington was so clearly qualified to fill. Unity in the executive promotes vigor and dispatch in office, Wilson noted, and by fixing responsibility on one person, served the best safeguard against tyranny. Elderbridge Gerry of Massachusetts added that a troika would be especially troublesome in war. It would be like a general with three heads, he declared. While these positions came out in the course of formal debate, delegates discussed them on other occasions as well. While most of the delegates lodged in crowded boarding houses in Philadelphia, Washington lived in Robert Morris's elegant manor, where he could dine in comfort every day. Still, he often ate out with the other delegates in groupings. Indeed, on June 2nd, after the extent of disagreement over the power and structure of the executive first became apparent, Washington chose to eat with the other delegates at City Tavern, where the subject of the day's heated debate likely came up and surely remained on everybody's mind. While in session earlier that day, that same day, the members had raised and could not resolve whether the United States should have one executive or three. Now, later in that day, as many of those delegates dined with the man who would be that king, Washington's presence must have reassured them. As a frequent guest at City Tavern, Pierce Butler may have been present. If so, it might explain his later comment that the powers vested in the executive, quote, would not have been so great had not many of the members cast their eyes to George Washington as president. At the convention's very next session, the next time they met after this dinner at City Tavern, the states voted by a margin of 7-3 for a single executive. Then, and on every other recorded occasion, Washington voted for a stronger executive. So it went for week after week as Washington successfully guided the convention to its historic conclusion in September, when all the remaining states voted for the Constitution, even though some delegates objected to parts of it. The convention then approved a cover letter signed only by Washington for transmitting the finished draft to Congress. The friends of our country have long seen and desired that the power of making war, peace, treaties, that of levying money and regulating commerce, and the corresponding executive and judiciary authorities should be fully and effectively vested in the general government, the letter stated. These factors, the letter claimed, justified the consolidation of our union, which is involved our prosperity, our safety, and perhaps our very national existence. This letter, signed only by Washington, opened the public campaign for ratification. It was printed in virtually every newspaper in the country. The accompanying resolutions asked Congress to forward the Constitution to the states for ratification, with 9 of them required to launch the new union. Washington's signature on the cover letter and the resolutions made it look as if the Constitution came from him. One day after the delegates signed the Constitution, Washington left for his beloved Mount Vernon, ostensibly to let the people work their will. Indeed, on the very day, he vowed not to, quote, say anything for or against ratification in public. Yet 2 days after reaching home, he sent copies of the Constitution to 3 former Virginia governors, along with identical letters urging them to support it. I sincerely believe that it is the best that could be obtained at this time, Washington wrote to his governors. If nothing had been agreed to, anarchy would soon have ensued. Well, with 2 of Virginia delegates having refused to sign the document and state leaders lining up behind them, Washington feared that the Constitution would face strong headwinds in the Old Dominion. As much as he genuinely wanted to live quietly on his plantation and sincerely eschewed political power, Washington had so much time and reputation invested in the Constitution and believed so strongly that his country could not survive without it, that its progress consumed him even as he resumed day-to-day management of his plantation. Like most Federalists, he was convinced that the choice lay between the Constitution or chaos. That was how he said it and put it. The preservation, as he would write, the preservation of liberty and property required ratification, and ratification required, he knew, required him. Early reports from every state sounded much the same. Federalists would rely on the public's trust in Washington to carry the day. Washington knew the role that his name and reputation were playing in the campaign for ratification. He received and read newspapers from around the country daily and followed the unfolding drama in them and through letters. Those reports carried endless references to his central role at the convention. Yet, most people likely cared less that he had signed the Constitution than he would lead the new government under it. Connecticut's David Humphrey wrote to Washington, "What will tend more than anything to the adoption of the new system will be a universal opinion of your being elected president." No doubt Washington saw it coming, and without coveting the position, he never denied that he would accept it. "Should the ideal prevail that you will not accept the presidency," Pennsylvania's Governor Morris warned about the Constitution's prospect, "it would prove fatal." By silence, Washington played his part. Even with him in the camp, however, Federalists faced a daunting task of securing ratification for their revolutionary shift of power from the states to the central government. Now, Federalists had the advantage of a document designed to address the grave economic and political problems then facing the country. And influential supporters returning from the convention to each state to push for ratification. But led at first by dissenting delegates and soon joined by New York Governor George Clinton and Virginia Orator Patrick Henry and others, anti-Federalists were organizing to stop ratification. Whether he liked it or not, the clash would draw in Washington. As opposition to the Constitution emerged, Washington enlisted supporters to defend it, asking many of them to campaign actively for its ratification. An October speech by Pennsylvania delegate James Wilson so pleased Washington that he sent copies to others, asked them to distribute it, asked them to reprint it in their local newspapers. He did the same when the Federalist Papers, anonymously written by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, written at his urging, by the way, began appearing. And as he came to identify more completely with the Constitution, Washington increasingly rallied against its opponents. "To alarm the people seems the groundwork of their plan," he complained at the time. "Every art that could have flamed the passions and touched the interests of men have been essayed. The ignorant have been told that should the proposed government obtain, their land would be taken from them and their property disposed of. Their fort," Washington said of anti-Federalists, "seems to lie in misrepresentation." In contrast to them, he believed that individual liberty and private property could only survive with the Constitution. "I never saw him so keen for anything in my life," one visitor wrote about Washington near the end of 1787. By then, even though five states had ratified the document, formidable opposition remained in the key states of Massachusetts, Virginia, and New York. Knowing their importance, Washington stepped up his involvement. Now, of course, Washington had already been deeply involved in ratification effort from the very beginning. He had personally endorsed the Constitution to public officials and influential people in Virginia and elsewhere. He had urged supporters with, quote, literary abilities to take up their pens on behalf of the cause, and he had helped distribute their results. He never objected when Federalists invoked his names and had dispatched scores of letters of his own supporting ratification. Now, to win in Massachusetts, Madison advised Washington that more might be required. "I have good reason to believe that if a proper occasion offended offered for an explicit communication of your good wishes for the plan, Madison wrote, that it would be attended with valuable effects. When Washington then received a note from one of his former officers who had been elected to the Massachusetts Ratifying Convention, he replied with a public letter stressing the importance of ratification by the Bay State. Even before the letter arrived, confirmation of Washington's position reached Massachusetts from another source. As noted, Washington often wrote private letters urging ratification. Key parts of one surfaced in a Virginia paper on December 27 and were reprinted by 9 Massachusetts newspapers during the state's ratifying convention, which began on January 9, 1788. Washington wrote in this letter about the Constitution, "There is no alternative between the adoption of it and anarchy, and clear I am, if another federal convention is attempted, that the sentiments of its members will be more discordant and less accommodating than the last. In fine, they will agree on no general plan." Federalists were hungry to hear such words from their icon. By March, some 50 newspapers had reprinted the letter. "I am fully persuaded that it is the best that can be obtained at this time," the extract said about the Constitution, "and that it is free of many of the defects with which it is charged, and that it or disunion is before us to choose from." In one sentence, Washington encapsulated the Federalist positions. The sides were so closely drawn in the Massachusetts Convention that Washington's support may have been decisive. An article in the Massachusetts Gazette suggested as much when it observed, quote, "The Federalists should be distinguished themselves hereafter by the name Washingtonians." Even after the state narrowly ratified the Constitution in February and others followed, the Constitution remained one state shy of the 9 required for ratification as Virginia, New Hampshire, and New York opened their conventions in June. "The plot thickens fast," Washington wrote as Virginia's ratifying convention neared. To deal with the threat posed by Patrick Henry's oratory, Washington all but ordered Madison to stand for election to the convention so that he could answer Henry point by point, a task that the shy, withdrawn Madison dreaded. When Madison's election looked doubtful without campaigning, Washington told him to stump for votes, another unpleasant task. Once the delegates convened, the debate went on for weeks, with neither side gaining a clear advantage. Between letters and newspaper reports, Washington received blow-by-blow accounts of the convention. Though at home, he might as well have been there. The truth was that not only in the Virginia Convention, but at all the state gatherings, Washington was always present, a force more powerful for being insubstantial. Washington's role in drafting the Constitution and the prospects of him becoming the president made all the difference. Alluding to Washington near the end of Virginia's convention, one anti-Federalist leader told the assembly, "Were it not for one great character in America, so many men would not be for this government." In making their arguments, Virginia anti-Federalists must have felt that they were shadowboxing with Washington, whose assumed role as president made what they saw as a fatally flawed system appear attractive to others. Well, on June 27, the evening stage brought news to Mount Vernon that Virginia had ratified the Constitution 2 days earlier. It passed by a 10-vote margin. Victors and vanquished alike recognized it as being as much a triumph for Washington as for the Constitution. "Be assured," Virginia anti-Federalist James Monroe said of Washington, "his influence carried this government." Well, these momentous events led Washington to reflect on all that Americans had achieved over the past year. So he wrote, upon hearing of Virginia's ratification, he wrote, "We have the unequaled privilege of choosing our own political institutions and of improving upon the experience of mankind in the formation of a confederated government where due energy will not be incompatible with the inalienable rights of freemen. In a world ruled by hereditary monarchs, traditional dogmas, or military might, nothing like America's Republican experience had ever occurred. We exhibit, at the present, the novel and astonishing spectacle, Washington wrote, of a whole people deliberating calmly on what form of government would be most conducive to their happiness and deciding with an unexpected degree of unanimity in favor of a system which they conceive calculated to answer the purpose. Where before Washington despaired of the country's survival as a free united republic, he now exuded confidence. He wrote, "When the people shall find themselves secure under an energetic government, when foreign nations shall be disposed to give us equal advantages in commerce from dread of retaliation, and when everyone under his own vine and fig tree shall begin to taste the fruits of freedom, then all of these blessings, for all of these blessings will surely come, will be referred to the fostering influence of the new government. America's second revolution," he's writing, "secured the gains won in the first, with Washington again leading the charge." Well, over the course of 1788, Washington had articulated three main goals for the United States under the Constitution: respect abroad, prosperity at home, and development westward. Toward those ends, he envisioned a vigorous federal government encouraging trade, manufacturing, and agriculture through effective tariffs, sound money, secure property rights, and a non-aligned foreign policy. Quote, "America under an efficient government will be the most favorable country of any in the world for persons of industry and frugality, and not less advantageous to the happiness of the lowest class of people because of the great plenty of unoccupied land in the West." This was Washington's vision for the United States. And as the nation's first president, he went a long way to recognizing it. It had required a second American Revolution, one conceived in the Confederation's failure, which became apparent in the mid-1780s, incubated in the Constitutional Convention, and given birth through a tortuous ratification process. Washington was there throughout, just as he had been there during the American Revolution, making him, as Henry Knox had predicted, truly the father of his country. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to Edward Larson speaking about his book, The Return of George Washington, covering the period of time between the end of his generalship and the beginning of his presidency. One idea from the beginning of your book, from another part of your book, that I thought would be very interesting to the audience is to explain about the Mississippi River politics, that it was closed off to Spain, and that there was a lot of backstory politics on that I thought was very interesting, people probably don't know about.
Lots of backstory politics, and Washington was in the middle of it. I'm trying to get back to this map if I can. It's way back to the front, and I don't know any quick way to do it. But it does sort of capture it. Get to review the talk. There we go. Come on, I think we're getting close. One more, two more, three more. There. Oh, way back. Way back. It was the second time. There it is. There. This sort of captures it. You see the Mississippi River. That's the western part of, that's the western boundary of the United States, in theory, under the peace treaty with England. But it wasn't effectively the western boundary. If you remember back in your history, after one of the things that caused the American Revolution was the proclamation of, 1763, when the British had, after had beaten the French and acquired Canada and the West, they drew a line at the Appalachians, saying that settlers couldn't move past that, and the Western territory was reserved for the Native Americans, with whom the British would trade. Well, after the Revolution, after in theory this land has been, after independence had been given to the New World, to America, the British didn't evacuate the forts in the Northwest. They remained in Detroit and the other forts they had in the West. They continued to trade with the Native Americans for furs, dominate the fur trade, and supply them with guns to allegedly to shoot the animals with furs. But of course, those same guns could also be used against American settlers just as easily, and they were, including Washington's agent, by the way. Washington's agent was captured by the Native Americans. Washington had owned land on the frontier in the Ohio Valley, and his agent out from before the Revolution, but he couldn't get to it because of the Proclamation of 1763. Well, after the Revolution, he wanted to exploit that land. He will make a trip west, which is really dramatic, during this time to visit the land, eventually driven back by the Native Americans. His agent had been killed the year before by the Native Americans. And what was happening out there is the British weren't evacuating the forts, and they had every intention of taking back the Northwest, the old Northwest Territory. Now, we're all sitting in California. Think what this all would have meant to us without George Washington. There wouldn't have been us. Well, there would have been us, but it would have been part of Spain. The Spanish New Orleans was then in the hands of Spain, and they were pushing into the Southwest, conspiring with the settlers there, moving into those areas. The American government had no army because we couldn't raise any taxes. And in the last 3 years of the Revolution, they hadn't paid their troops for the last 3 years. They'd stuck together, sort of, to fight the Revolution, but then they went home, and so there was no army. So there was no army to claim the West. The states, as part of the earlier deals, had given up, states with claims to the West had given up those claims, so they were national territory, territory under the central government, but the central government couldn't do anything to secure those lands. When Washington went west during this period to visit, because he's trying to restore his plantation and his ownings had fallen into disarray during the Revolution. He'd been away for 9 years without leave, and so he was trying to restore his plantation and his frontier lands to prosperity. Once he spends 6 months on his plantation, he heads west to look at the frontier lands. And he found frontiersmen squatting on some of his lands, and they wouldn't move, and they wouldn't pay him. He found other lands. He couldn't find anybody to rent them. When he tried to get to his largest landholdings, he couldn't go there because he was warned that the Native Americans were waiting, and they were going to capture him and hold him for ransom or worse. So he turns back. And he comes back and he just says, the frontier's on a pivot. It's on a pivot. We're going to lose it. They're going to go where they can trade. And they're either going to have to trade north to the St. Lawrence in Canada, or they're going to have to, to the extent they're out there, or they're going to have to go to the Mississippi River, and then they're going to go with Spain. Spain's closed the border, so you couldn't come out through Spain. Spain's holding out, hoping to reacquire the land and saying, you can't trade here until you join us. Vermont is actively conspiring with Canada at this time to join British Canada, break off. And he just comes back and says Washington, you know, he really didn't covet power. He made a lot of money, but he didn't really covet money. He was very introspective, and he had said even in his youth that what I really desire is to leave a legacy. Fame is what I care about, a legacy. He was, at the end of the Revolution, the most famous person, arguably, in the world, certainly the greatest celebrity in the United States. His fame was gained. But if this whole place had collapsed, if we'd broken apart into pieces, if we didn't get the frontier, he, like Franklin and the others, realized our future was on the frontier. It's only what makes America different is we have this outlet for our people, West, opportunity. Otherwise, we'll become like Europe. And we're going to lose it. And even the Union is going to break apart because they're all fighting against each other. And so the only way he's going to have his legacy is by going west. And the Mississippi River played a major, major part in it. Now, during this time, Jay, to try to keep the Spanish out of the actual territory, negotiated a treaty that acknowledged Spain's power to close the river. And Washington, the South was outraged. You're giving up our future, our outlet for our thing. Washington privately says, I don't know why in the world Spain won't open the New Orleans, because if they will, they're going to tie everybody to New Orleans. But this is fine with me, because it's going to keep it's going to make the frontiersmen not like Spain. That's what we need. He was that sort of a political thinker. And so the treaty ends up not passing. He, of course, secures a treaty as president, opening this area, but only after he has built an army with which he can defend it. So what the frontier policies would play into us, because there wouldn't be a West. And if there wouldn't have been a West, wouldn't an East have remained? So Washington was thinking about all these things and these ideas that he just went back to his plantation during these 5 years when the country was coming apart are far from true. I'll try to be shorter on the next one, but it was a great question.
Thanks very much. You spoke of three regions at this time.
Yes.
Would that be New England, the South, and the Mid-Atlantic?
Yes. Yes, those are the three. They viewed that they had three distinct regions. They called them then the East because they referred to what we call as New England. They always called it the Eastern states because they stick out east. And then the Middle and then the South. And that's what they always referred to. And they definitely meant the slave states of the South, the states of Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, maybe Maryland in the middle, and then the East.
And was Virginia, much like it is today, kind of a divided state in terms of attitudes?
No, it was mostly a southern state. It was more a southern state back then. Washington was very much a nationalist, but Washington was an outlier. He had become a nationalist because of his time spent around the country. Remember, for the previous 9 years, during the Revolution, he had fought and lived in Massachusetts, he'd fought and lived in New Jersey, he'd fought and lived in New York most of the time, and in Pennsylvania. He had ties and allegiances and very close friends in all those states. Think of Henry Knox, think of John Jay, think of George Clinton, think of the Morrises. And, of course, his officers, who he was very close with his officers, and his aides-de-camp, who would often sleep in the same building that was his headquarters, had dispersed around the nation. So he really had a national perspective. The only other Virginian, Madison did, but the only one equivalent to Washington's view was John Marshall. And John Marshall, who later becomes Chief Justice, played a major role in the Virginia ratifying convention. It was a critical role. And that's when he thought very much like Madison, Washington. So when you think of what Marshall later does with his various Supreme Court decisions. And, of course, Marshall's great writing thing is he writes a biography of Washington. I mean, he almost channels Washington. He views himself as Washington's legacy.
Next question.
And he was, of course, a Virginian.
Another Virginian, Thomas Jefferson, anti-federalist, more in favor of some pure democracy, somewhat at odds. Was the federalism, this insecurity, was it in danger, particularly with Thomas Jefferson's views?
Thomas Jefferson is a chameleon during this time. That's what he includes Randolph of, but it applies to. It's tough to know exactly what Jefferson thought. Jefferson was over in France as the American ambassador to France. Washington knew throughout the entire, even before the Constitutional Convention, but certainly during it, when he saw what was evolving, he knew that Virginia was going to be a tough fight because he suspected Patrick Henry would be very much opposed, and Patrick Henry had an enormous following, and he was a very powerful former governor. And he didn't know, I mean, he worried about Mason and others. And so Washington's cultivating, and Madison. Madison is very much in Washington's camp. They had worked together very closely. The 2 months before going to Philadelphia for the convention, Madison had lived at Mount Vernon. Madison was single then, and he's like his mid-30s, no family. He was a policy wonk. You know, he was this little guy who was just a policy wonk. And he had lived at Mount Vernon. And that's when a lot of they sort of fleshed out what would be the Constitution. And Madison was very committed. He feared the states, especially the states that had, like Pennsylvania and Rhode Island, had a one-house legislature. He feared a majority faction. He cared a lot about liberty. He cared a lot about property rights. And he feared that a majority faction would take over and take away the liberty and property of the minority. You see that later in the Federalist Papers. But he clearly feels that going in. And so his libertarian defense, as it were, of the Constitution was that in a nation we'd be too big to have a majority faction. You'd have to have a lot of minorities who lump together and therefore compromise, and that will protect liberty, property. And he was talking a lot about this. He was thinking a lot about this. It comes out in the Federalist Papers. So he's convinced we need a national government. So he's working very closely with Washington. And you could see during the entire period, during the entire time they're in Philadelphia, they're both sending a lot of letters over to Jefferson to keep Jefferson on board because they don't know what way Jefferson's going to go. And Washington is writing these tremendously powerful letters saying, you're over there in France. You don't know what's happening here. This whole thing is going to collapse without this. We're going to have anarchy. We're going to have no country if we don't get this. You're not going to be able to negotiate people. That's what Washington's saying. Madison is describing what's happening at the convention in not so accurate terms, in ways that would make it look Jefferson be more supportive of. You know, he's sort of tilting. He's sort of presenting a little bit of, I think, a little bit of a biased view. Washington never does that, but Washington is taking another tack. They're clearly working together to work on Jefferson. There were tremendous accusations, and so Jefferson never takes a position, and to the except that he mildly endorses the Constitution. And they think, you know, he's a former governor. His view carries a lot of weight. Now, so they're trying to work Jefferson to keep him on board. There was many accusations at the time that Washington promised Jefferson a cabinet post if he endorsed the Constitution. And he does endorse the Constitution. And he gets a cabinet post. We don't have the letter making the offer, but the charge was that Washington had promised both Randolph and Jefferson cabinet posts if they backed the convention Constitution, and they both, of course, got cabinet posts. And that's the type of thing Washington would do, but he'd cover his tracks pretty well. So if he did, we don't know. But those were the accusations that were written in many newspapers and were charged by anti-federalists because they were very frustrated that Jefferson did back ratification, but in a sort of a mild-mannered way. And Randolph flips, and then Randolph famously, in the middle of the convention, reverses himself and endorses it, and he, of course, becomes Attorney General, and Jefferson becomes Secretary of State. So Jefferson's a complicated story. And then after he's in office, he backs Washington for election. He backs him for re-election. He pleads with Washington for run for re-election. But he cools toward Hamilton, and this war sort of begins within the administration between Jefferson pulling one way and Madison by this time is disenfranchised. You know, general view is that Madison was Washington's prime minister during the first half of his first term, but he gets eclipsed by Hamilton, who's very much a strong nationalist. So, you know, you have this pulling. I mean, they say that, you know, Doris Kearns Goodwin famously said that Lincoln has his team of rivals in his cabinet. That ain't nothing to compare to what Washington put in his cabinet. When you think of Hamilton and Jefferson, larger than anybody Lincoln ever pulled in his cabinet, and you talk about team of rivals, and then you add Randolph and Henry Knox to that cabinet, then you throw in Adams as vice president and Madison as the key inner voice, you really have a team of rivals. But that's the way Washington already operated. He really opposed parties, and he really wanted to listen to all sides, he strongly believed in compromise and in cooperation and in Republican virtue. And he always had this hope that if you got everybody in the room, they would talk together and then hear out everything and then agree on some sort of a solution. And that's the way he liked to lead. But that's the way he led as a general, too. He was a successful political general like an Eisenhower. He wasn't really a military general. He was a military general, but he was a political general. That was his role. He had to keep all the states in the war. He was, you know, like Eisenhower had to handle D-Day with, you know, anybody who could get Churchill and De Gaulle and Patton and Montgomery to work together is amazing. And Washington was like that, not like the Grant or the other generals we've had as president.
There's time for one more question.
In your opinion, you just described a number of strengths that George Washington had. What would you describe as some of his shortcomings? And maybe could you relate that perhaps to this struggle which we've all inherited, it's our legacy today between, you know, a strong central government and states' rights?
Washington did. I mean, we were tremendously blessed to have George Washington as our first president. I mean, not only when he was president, but in the years leading up during the war and then during, I mean, if he hadn't, you know, had the courage to try crossing the Delaware when everything looked like it was defeated, or if had taken a risk by shifting everybody down to Yorktown, then taking these risks with the Constitutional Convention. So he had a lot of strengths. He had a dignity. He had a sense of popular opinion. You know, John Adams, who always, you know, couldn't get along with anybody, and thought the worst of everybody. I mean, anybody who could attack Ben Franklin the way Adams did didn't realize it was Ben Franklin who negotiated the treaty with France, not him. But the same way with Washington. He said, Washington was the best political actor I've ever seen. And he meant that as an insult, but I think it's true. I think Washington was a great political actor. But, of course, he wasn't some things. He wasn't a speaker, and speaking was powerful, but he had these terrible teeth. And he had, you know, I can't imagine him really speaking because his teeth would have fallen out while he was talking. He was a great conversationalist. He was a retail politician. He was great. He was like Reagan. He could talk to everybody in the room, and he told stories, and he mesmerized people one-on-one, danced with all the ladies. The ladies loved him. The men loved him. He was tremendously effective one-on-one, but he wasn't a speaker. So that limits his ability. Even his great farewell address, which is a magnificent piece of writing, he didn't write it, of course, but he knew how to delegate. He was a great delegator, like any general is. But it was published in the newspapers; it wasn't spoken. And so it would have had. This was an era of great oratory, and he couldn't contribute to that. So that, I suppose, would be a weakness. He didn't anticipate political parties, and since he didn't anticipate political parties, he didn't know how to navigate in a world when. He thought everybody should, he knew ideologies, he knew people had difference of opinions. He was great at meshing those, but what he couldn't deal with was when they locked all their ideas together. And they were a party. And what he'd do is he could take each issue, and he was a great compromiser, he was a great listener, and you could see it in the Constitutional Convention with the things like the Three-Fifths Compromise and the Great Compromise and all these other things, and his key role in those and the grading of the presidency. I mean, he listens to a lot of pieces, and they go together. They come together. But he can't deal with people during his second term when they begin to become locked in a, where they vote as a coordinated party group. And that, he just can't understand it, and it frustrates him. And also, he has a famous temper. I mean, he has a terrible temper, which he controls in public. Nobody in public knows he really has it. But in private, I mean, he'll just explode, and then he has to calm himself down and come back out. So those, in a way, were all limitations that he had. But they, I mean, if Ben Franklin had been younger, I think Ben Franklin could have pulled it off. But those were the only two. They were the two celebrities. And everybody else was just was local, really. We think back of them, and we sometimes make some of these people like John Jay national, but they were really all local, and they really did have a. These two were national celebrities, trusted throughout. And Washington, more than anything, key for getting the Constitution passed, which they thought he'd be president, is the people could trust him with power because he had voluntarily turned it over. Everybody knew he could have stayed there after the war. And that he voluntarily relinquished power made them trust him with more. And that was critical. But and then he does it again. He retires again and tries to create a legacy of going back. And so these were, I dwell on these strengths, but I try to put them in context. And, of course, he never could. Finally, I guess I'll have to. You have to say, I mean, you have to deal with his issue on slavery. You know, you can say, what you want. I mean, here he was. How does he deal with slavery? I mean, you have to view him as a period of the time. I mean, when he was raised with slaves, his family had slaves, all of his neighbors had slaves, all of his neighbors who had wealth had slaves. At the time when he was young, every country in the world had slaves. They had slaves in Africa, they had slaves in Europe, they had slaves in China, they had slaves everywhere. The Native Americans had slaves, everybody had slaves. And he has a tough time dealing with, and he grapples with that issue because during the Revolution, for the first time, people start turning against slavery. And some of his, he's very close, he has almost like a father-son relationship with his aides, his close aides, people like Henry Lawrence and James Madison later, he wasn't an aide during the war, Humphreys, Hamilton, you know what, Lawrence and Hamilton and his closest of all, Lafayette, they all turned on slavery. They all pleaded with him during the Revolution, free your slaves, set a model. Henry Lawrence did free his slaves, or his father did after Lawrence died. And he, you know, he couldn't, you know, he would speak privately against it, but he thought you needed to keep them, how are you going to keep the South in without slaves? How's my plantation going to work? Patrick Henry was a big believer in slavery. Will he turn even more against us? What will happen? But then you have to compare him with Ben Franklin, who had owned slaves when he was younger. And Ben Franklin, even though he's 20 years older than Washington, Ben Franklin changes. Ben Franklin becomes the president of the first, creates the first abolition society in Pennsylvania. And then when the Constitution is passed, he continually sends in petitions till he dies, pleading with the abolition of slavery. And he only goes along with the Three-Fifths Compromise when he concludes that the South will bolt without this. But if we keep them in, then they'll keep slaves forever. If we keep them in, someday this country is going to force them to get rid of their slaves. And that's the way Ben Franklin's thinking. Washington never quite gets there. And that's, he does, though, on his deathbed. You know, he's dying. He's asked for his two wills that he's drafted. He looks at them both. He knows he's going to die within a few hours. He rips up one, and we don't know what's in it. The other one frees his slaves on his deathbed. You know? I don't think he wants to be on the wrong side of history, but there's another issue that you have to deal with. You have to deal with the fact that he continued to own slaves and trade. He kept saying he was going to stop trading in them, but he kept getting more. He never can quite break from slavery. So, anyway, long answer. And you told me it was the last one.
And an excellent answer.
Sorry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 112th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.